Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. In just a second, we're going to have a very interesting conversation with two people from the School District of La Crosse. We're going to talk to Superintendent Dr. Aaron Engel about how this semester is going, how COVID is or isn't affecting the semester, and what his expectations are as the year goes on. And then Jen Kalis will be joining us. She's the Early Childhood and 4K Program Support Coordinator. And we're going to be talking to Jen about a very exciting new development that's going to enhance access to preschool across our community. And I'm excited to hear about that. First of all, a note about last week. Due to a technical impairment, we were not able to air the segment with the Sustainability Institute of La Crosse about how individuals just like you and me can get involved in making seemingly small decisions that all add up to have a huge environmental impact. So we're going to be airing that conversation later in today's show. You'll hear that in about 30 minutes. Right now, we welcome to the show Dr. Aaron Engel, the superintendent of La Crosse Public Schools. Dr. Engel, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thank you for having me.
Jen Kalis is the Early Childhood and 4K Program Support Coordinator. Jen, thanks a lot for being on Newsmakers. Dr. Engel, as I ask my niece and nephew every time I see them, how's school going?
It's another COVID year, you know, which has brought its own challenges, but we are excited to have kids in person at school learning with their teachers. And that has made this year great to start with, direct contrast to last year and the end of the previous one. So excited to have kids at school every day, excited to be learning and seeing that joy that comes from being with their friends, their teachers at school.
Kids are meant to be with each other and meant to socialize with each other and just develop differently when they're not able to do that. How is this year as compared to the previous couple of years, your first years in La Crosse, how is this year comparing to those previous experiences?
Yeah, I started last year on July 1st. So in the midst of the pandemic, the early stages where we knew a lot less than we do today. And as we learn more, we found that with good mitigation strategies, we can keep kids at school and learning. And we've been able to do that this year, which has been really exciting. We've seen some schools around the state have to go to AB days or maybe close entirely for periods of time. And we're just thankful that we haven't had to do that. You know, certainly could happen in the future if things got really bad. But, you know, we've been able to put in place some great mitigation strategies. Our parents have followed through and helped us out as best they can. Our teachers have been doing an amazing job in our schools, helping reinforce those strategies, and it's kept kids in person learning where they learn best.
So what COVID protocols do you expect your students and staff to follow?
Yeah, based on what we've learned over this year, there's some really basic things that we've been doing. We wear masks when we're at school and inside, and we keep 3 feet of distance wherever possible. In certain circumstances, we try and extend that out to 6 feet. And then, of course, we wash our hands. We have good HVAC in place. And we use contact tracing and quarantines as necessary. Those are always the difficult things for parents to grapple with. But the result has been most kids have been in school for most of the year. And that's really what our goal is.
I know a lot of people are glad to see athletics happening again this year and other extracurriculars, performance opportunities for the kids. Are there differences between those activities that happen indoors versus outdoors? I know I was at the Central Holman game last week, and obviously it's outside. You know, nobody's wearing a mask or anything like that. But I know, you know, if somebody's got a concert or a theater performance or something inside, those restrictions might be different.
Yeah, we're definitely using different strategies indoors and outdoors. You know, when our kids go out for recess, we don't require them to wear a mask because we know that that's not where spread of COVID typically happens. And when we have a football game, we're not worried about wearing masks there because we know that that's not as large a danger. When we're indoors, though, of course, we have different procedures. And so as we think about band concerts and theater productions and other sorts of indoor activities, we're using, you know, what we know works, trying to keep social distancing, wearing masks wherever possible. You know, there are certain circumstances where we might have to cancel, delay, or kind of change how we we do an event, but we're trying to keep everything in place as much as we can, because those special events mean so much to the kids that are participating, and of course to the families that want to be there to see them.
So from an academic point of view, do you know yet how last year, the last year and a half, really affected the students who were going through that, and really are there different ways that it affected students based on like grade level?
Yeah, as we look back at our assessments from last year, we know that relative to a more traditional year, kids did not pick up as much as it relates to the specific types of reading and math assessments that we do. Now, that's not what we want, right? We want every kid to achieve as much as possible. But we also know that kids learned a lot of other things that weren't on those tests. You know, they learned new vocabulary, what a quarantine is, or how COVID is transmitted. Kids learned how to be sensitive and kind to each other in ways that they have not historically. And so we're certainly seeing some delays in our academic achievement, and we're working hard to catch up on all that. But we also know that kids learned a lot of stuff that wasn't tested this last year, and we're really thankful for some of those skills and knowledge that they've gotten. I bet we've generated a whole future cohort of scientists that are interested in virology and public health that we would have never had before. And I can only imagine in 10, 15 years as they're graduating from college, what that will mean for the success of our society and the future of our community.
Well, experience informs interest so often, doesn't it?
Absolutely. When we take kids on field trips, we quickly generate a whole population of kids that want to be firefighters if it's at the fire department. Or when we take them to a planetarium, all of a sudden we've got a bunch of kids that want to be astronauts and explore the stars. And it's no different with this last year. Kids are intrigued by the things that they're experiencing and maybe want to pursue that as a career. And it'll be interesting to see over the next years and decades to see how this has impacted our students in positive ways, as well as the ones that we're challenged by right now.
You talked about noticing, at least in the testable subject areas, you noticed some difference between what might happen in a typical year and last year. What are you having to do? Where are you having to apply additional resources to make up the difference or close the gap?
Yeah, the easy answer is everywhere. We've used our ESSER funds, money given by the government to address COVID related issues in schools. We've used that to add what we're calling success coaches at the elementary, middle, and high school level. We know that nearly every one of our kids was affected, likely academically, and we're trying to identify where they're currently at, what they need to do to get back on track. And we've got extra people in place to help make sure that that happens. We also know that not being in school for a year affected kids' ability to regulate and manage in a traditional classroom. You know, their emotional and behavioral supports, you know, we're not there for almost a year for some kids. And so we're trying to reinforce those things as well, provide extra support for kids so that they can regulate their behavior and find ways to manage in a traditional classroom now that they haven't been there for a while. So we're providing support academically, social, emotionally, for behavior at all levels to ensure that students get what they need to be able to succeed and get back on track.
Well, you talked about having a success coach. I've never heard of that. What does a success coach do? I want one.
Everybody should have one, and we're thankful our kids do right now. It functions like an interventionist. So they'll work with students and teachers, identify where there's some challenges. You know, maybe a student is struggling with their sounds, their vowels, and a success coach will be able to work with that student for a little bit to help them out. But that success coach will also work with the teacher to develop a system to ensure that every kid gets what they need in that classroom. And so we're not just working with individual students, we're working with classrooms and creating structures that will allow every kid to reach their potential.
You talked about dedicating ESSER funds, COVID relief funds, to those kinds of efforts. Obviously you'd want all the funding in the world to do as many things as you could think of to positively impact children. Are there things that you could use more of or areas where you're not able to pay enough attention or where resources are just too slim?
More money is always better than less. I think we've taken a really smart approach with our ESSER funds and really thought about what our kids need to succeed over these next 2 to 3 years. So these ESSER funds have been crucial in doing that. I think we could always use more academic interventions. We could always use more social workers. I think right now, one of the things that we're really noticing is mental health as being a focus issue. And, you know, if we were able to develop more partnerships for mental health services, I think that would be incredibly beneficial right now. You know, there's limited resources in our community as well, which can be challenging from time to time. But that's something that we're really focused on. The thing that complicates the use of ESSER funds for our school district and for others is that the state budget really provided no new money for schools. And so in 2 to 3 years, we're going to be in a really challenging position as these funds fall off and we're left with budgets that have really been cut due to rising inflation.
So basically, if I understand it correctly, based on, my own consumption of news, the state basically said because of these additional funds, we're basically going to count that as what you normally would receive in an increase in funding to schools, right? So there isn't any higher state appropriation that normally would come as like a kind of like a cost of living raise, to put it in terms that people might use in their own budgeting.
That's exactly correct. Historically, maybe not in the last 10 years, but historically, schools have gotten about a 2% increase in funding each year, which accounts for basic things like fuel costs increasing, the cost of utilities going up, the cost of school books going up. And so those are the sorts of things that help us keep our budget balanced every year. If we don't get that cost of living increase, so to speak, then that means we have to cut budgets to become balanced. And I think the state legislature thought that COVID funds could work to help fill that gap. But, you know, over the course of 2 years, it's going to create a 4 to 6% hole that we're going to find ourselves in and not have access to those federal funds any longer. So not the approach I would have chosen in funding education. We've really decided to use those ESSER funds to do more for kids than we have historically. A lot of school districts are in really tough positions, though, where they have to use it for basic operations. And that was certainly never the intent of ESSER funds from the federal government's perspective.
Dr. Aaron Engel is the superintendent of La Crosse Public Schools. We're talking about this year's experience in the schools compared to last year, how COVID is affecting things, even though students are back in person, back in class, and that's certainly good to see. Dr. Engel, I'm glad that you're with us today. Also with us is Jen Kalis, who's the Early Childhood and 4K Program Support Coordinator for La Crosse Public Schools. And we're going to talk to Jen next about a very exciting new mobile preschool, which is something I've never heard of and I can't wait to ask about. That's coming up next on Newsmakers. If you'd like to get in touch with our program today, you can always send us an email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking to Dr. Aaron Engel and Jen Kalis from the La Crosse Public Schools, and we're talking now about a mobile preschool, which is an idea that I had never heard about, but it's a brand new thing that the La Crosse schools are doing this year. Jen, tell me, what is a mobile preschool?
So our mobile preschool in La Crosse was just launched this year. It was something that we did, like Dr. Engel was speaking of, using ESSER funds as ways to close the gap and also improve learning for all kids through COVID. We had the idea for a while that we really wanted to have a preschool program that we could bring to the students instead of always having the students travel to the preschool program. So we are very blessed with some high quality, amazing 4K or 4-year-old kindergarten preschool programs within each elementary and also in a few select community sites that we partner with. But what we were finding is that, especially during COVID, we were missing missing kids, where some students were experiencing homelessness, or they weren't able to actually come into the school for a variety of reasons. In addition, other preschool programs that we partner with, like Head Start, they had very long waiting lists. And we firmly believe that providing a high quality preschool experience for all is important. And the way we decided to do that is through a mobile preschool. So we purchased an RV and completely renovated it. So it looks just like a preschool classroom on the inside. The outside, we have some neat graphics, and you might see it driving by your neighborhood with all the cute kids' faces. We tried to have it represent the kids that we see in La Crosse. And right now, that mobile preschool is available for both a 4K or preschool program and also some community outreach.
You've got the mobile preschool. It's a refurbished or sort of completely redesigned mobile home, as it were. What is the reaction of a kid when they see this thing for the first time?
I'm so glad you asked, because I wish I could just have everybody see a video of when the kids walk up. And I think the first look is always kind of that in complete awe when they see the outside. And then when they come on in the inside, it's very difficult to get them back off. They've been having a lot of fun. Thankfully, Dr. Engel is able to come and join us one day and even had some pretend tea with some of our kids. But we are really targeting a smaller group of kids in this mobile preschool program so that we can really ensure that these kids have access, more individualized attention, access to the high quality preschool. And also we are providing free lunch and breakfast for the next day that we provide on the bus, as we call it.
So how many kids at a time are coming to the mobile preschool?
Yeah, our goal is to have around 6 or 7 kids at one time. We currently have 4 children enrolled. We were kind of anticipating we might have more than that right off the bat, but we literally just got this rolling here at the end of August when everything came together. So this is just our first week of really the news media, but we'd welcome a few more students. And again, we're really trying to find 4-year-old children who haven't had a preschool experience or aren't already connected to a preschool. And specifically, we're looking for kids who are 4 years old on or before September 1st.
So what is the value long-term? I mean, this isn't like people think of preschool and they conflate it with daycare. This is not daycare. This is like an actual educational environment. How important is it to get kids involved with learning things in a somewhat structured environment at age 3, age 4?
Yes, the research is just so clear. When we know that 90% of a child's brain is developed before the age 5, it just really puts that emphasis in that these early years are so important. And we really believe in La Crosse to approach things with an equity lens. And one of the first things we think about is we need all children to have an experience of this more structured preschool so that they can have the skills and dispositions to be ready for kindergarten. The 5-year-old kindergarten is not the kindergarten that you and I grew up in when we were little, half-day programs. And so it is more structured, and they kind of expect kids to come in learning or being maybe having some more skills than they have in the past. So that's why one of the real reasons we want kids to have a positive preschool experience. So when they come to us for kindergarten, they have already had a positive experience with the school. They've got foundation skills and social emotional learning, and even ABC 1-2-3 kind of things are ready, and they've learned how to be a learner.
So what kind of classes? Is it classes that they take on the mobile preschool? It doesn't feel much like class. It feels like just fun. But how do you determine what are the important subjects that they need to focus on?
Yes. So for our existing class right now that is running itself like one of our typical 4K programs, you can expect to see that kids are going to work on small muscle development, such as puzzles. They're going to do gross motor skills, playing outside, getting to climb, jump, run, and do all those important things that kids need to do to be able to learn. And then they're going to have a few things that are more structured, like a little circle time activity, which would include recognizing a friend's name in print, maybe making some choices, doing some songs and learning. And of course, there's always got to be some art activities. And so we try to blend learning with the actual art and sensory experiences for all of those kids.
And as you mentioned, this is all kind of in an effort to make sure that kids show up to kindergarten well prepared. What should a kid be expected to do or know prior to arriving at kindergarten? Like, I mean, I know you're not going to kick anybody out of kindergarten because they can't hold a book the right way. But like, what is it going to be most helpful for them, I should say, to be already skilled and experienced at before they show up to kindergarten?
Yeah, well, I'm sure Dr. Engel will back me up when I say a child is ready when they are 5 years old and they have their shots. That's our first prerequisite for kindergarten. But the things that are a little bit different maybe than even, 10 years ago is that kindergarten is a full day experience. And if you're a child who's never had a childcare experience or never had an opportunity to be in more of a group setting, it would just might take a little bit longer to get used to that routine. And we really want kids to have smooth transitions. So it's more about those social dispositions that they maybe know how to or have started to share with friends, that they know how to use some of the learning materials appropriately. Any preschool or kindergarten teacher can tell you what a gift it is if children come in and they're able to open their own milk carton or maybe even the glue bottle. So certainly not chemistry or anything high level like that, but we want kids to be socially and emotionally feel like they're ready for that full day of kindergarten.
The educational experts of various kinds that I've talked to throughout my career are always talking about statistics and things that I can't quite wrap my mind around. But it's always, things like how many words this cohort of children has been exposed to prior to kindergarten or prior to third grade versus this other cohort of children. Are those things that you factor in when you're planning and designing how your 4K program works?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned that. So early literacy in particular is a really strong portion of our curriculum for 4K. And we also know that kids learn best in the context of hands-on, playful learning and really fun activities. And so what we tried to blend with the mobile preschool is the opportunity for kids to really access lots of words, lots of books, lots of literacy in our half-day preschool program, but also in a way that's meaningful and that's engaging and that will really stick with them as time goes on.
So you talked about this being funded by rescue plan funding, by COVID relief funding as well. That enables the start of a model like this. Is this something that you're hoping to carry forward, in the future if additional funding could be provided?
Yes, and Dr. Engel, you just pop in if you have anything to add. But while we created this program kind of quickly, we had the idea for a long time, but we were thinking of long-term use of the vehicle and have full plans to keep it part of our program. The things that will be added to it in the near future are some what we call child find activities. The school district is responsible for locating and offering to screen developmentally any child in the community. And so what we want to do is bring our mobile preschool to different places in the community, probably in the mornings and at a time that we've already selected and that has been brought to the community's attention so they know we're coming. And that we could have those children come in with their families, We could do screening for developmental, any kind of areas of need, including just speech and language. A lot of families have questions about speech and language development. And from that developmental screening, the kids could come on the bus, they could play. We could provide them with some information, not only school-based resources, but community resources as well. So we do have big hopes for even this time next year, having a strong community outreach program to match.
I would just add that the ESSER funding provided the startup costs, so to speak, to purchase the RV and some of the materials and the renovations. But the increase in students attending our 4K early childhood program, that increased enrollment will fund the cost of those teachers as we move forward. So it's self-sustaining after this initial startup cost.
Oh, that's good to hear. So as you look to the years to come, like, what's the, do you hope that this is like kind of a new model for preschool, or at least how some kids might do preschool, or is this always going to be like a much smaller program geared for just a few students?
Yeah, I'm so excited about the program in general, because I think our focus, again, is making sure that all kids who are age eligible in our La Crosse School District have access to high quality preschool. And so this is going to be one of the options, and it might meet the needs of some students better than others. And so we're just glad to have it as an option. We also did model this program after there are a few existing traveling preschool programs in the United States, Colorado and California also have mobile preschools. And as part of our startup, I was able to connect with them and kind of look to them to see what other unique ways have they used their mobile preschool. And they've continued to give us really good ideas. So we are open to collaborating and look forward to just being readily available to our young kids and families in the community.
I can just see winter already coming. It's going to be so cold. And who wants to go outside and hop on a vehicle to have school in the middle of the cold? How's this going to work in December, January? Oh my gosh, February.
No, I'm sure it's going to be 65 and sunny all winter. So thankfully, as I mentioned, we had reached out to Colorado's preschool traveling program, because I knew they probably had winter as well. And some of the advice that they gave us was to do what you can to do a little extra heating. Certainly where we're parked at right now, and that specific spot, we have access to electricity to keep everything warm. However, from the very beginning, we did think about this. And the teacher who runs the 4K mobile preschool in the afternoon, she is a teacher in Soda One, which is part of Hamilton Elementary, in the morning. So her classroom is available in the afternoon, and we could easily pivot to get those kids into a brick and mortar if by some reason it's below zero, which I hope it won't be.
Now that everybody's all interested and has heard you kind of sell the program, where can they get more information or even sign up if they want to?
We would love anybody to call the district. Our preschool number office is 608-789-7006. And hopefully in the very near future, when we have a new program assistant, we will be updating our website with more information about where we're going to be. We'd even tossed around the idea of doing like a little Facebook page. But we are welcoming any questions, comments. Anybody want to see a little tour of it, we'd love to show you.
In case somebody missed it, what's that phone number one more time?
Sure. So you're going to reach us at 608-789-7006.
Jen Kalis is the Early Childhood and 4K Program Support Coordinator. Jen, thank you much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Aaron Engel is the superintendent of La Crosse Public Schools. Dr. Engel, thanks a lot for being here again.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can find all our previous episodes on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. And we'll be back with a conversation with the Sustainability Institute of La Crosse. That's coming up right after this on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Today on the program, we are talking about sustainability. We're talking about individual people and their impact on the environment and some surprising ways that you might be able to have a positive impact on the environment around you and climate change and the whole works. Joining us today to talk about that are two individuals from the Sustainability Institute of La Crosse. We've got Casey Meehan, the Director of Programming at the Sustainability Institute, and Carrie Thompson, their Operations and Programming Coordinator. Casey, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's good to be here as always, Ezra.
And Carrie, thank you for coming as well.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're really excited to talk with you today.
It's I'm looking forward to a good conversation, and we're talking about sustainability. That obviously intersects with climate change and all of those things. Is there a specific thing, Casey, that you mean when we start talking about sustainability? Is there a single definition of what that means?
There are some definitions that are sort of common out there. So lots of times people define sustainability as meeting our needs right now while not compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. But really, we like to think about sustainability more, maybe in more inspiring ways. So that definition is, in some ways, it's kind of blah, right? I mean, it's about survival. And that's not all that exciting to think about. It's not all that compelling. I mean, if I were to talk about my relationship with my wife and say, well, yeah, it's sustainable, that doesn't really sound all that exciting, right? So I want my relationship to thrive. And that's really sustainability. When it comes right down to it, it's about thriving, right? It's about building building communities that are thriving, so that are socially just, that are, that are vibrant. Those are the types of words that to me really bring sustainability and make it come alive and make it exciting and compelling and just a fun vision to be a part of.
Assuming that what we're talking about is thriving and bright and forward-looking rather than survivalist, why is sustainability an important thing for people to be talking about in our public, communal conversations?
Well, I mean, sustainability, we're all part of the story. We might think that this is just something that environmentalists are interested in, but really all of us are part of this story, because all of us, everyone that I've talked to, at least, really they want to make the community a better place, and their homes better places, right? And that's what sustainability is all about. It's about bringing out those conditions so that everybody has the opportunity to thrive. So whether regardless of what your occupation is or what your status and position in life is, all of us want the same thing, and that's to have the opportunity to thrive. So that's really where sustainability comes in. It's not, yes, it's sure about stewarding the environment, right? We all want clean air and need clean water and things like that. But it's so much more than that. We also want, we want a voice in the decisions that are made that impact us. We want to be affirmed for who we are and what we look like and how we identify. We want access to jobs that are pay a living wage and that offer benefits. We want access to healthcare. These are all matters of central importance to sustainability. So it really does involve sort of every aspect of our lives.
Talk about your organization generally before we get down to the specific conversation we're having today, which is about the drawdown challenge that's coming up. What's more the role of the Sustainability Institute in our community?
So I'll take a stab at this, and then Carrie, if you want to jump in as well, please do. Really, we envision the Sustainability Institute. It's its own separate 501c3. It happens to be housed at Western Technical College, but it's its own sort of identity. And the Sustainability Institute is really about this forward-looking view of sustainability, right? So what we're hoping to do, what the mission really with the Sustainability Institute is to help people within the Driftless region think about sustainability in positive ways, and really to offer inspiration about what could be. So oftentimes, when we think about climate change and sustainability, sometimes it's couched in a real doom and gloom mentality, right? That everything's kind of heading downhill. And well, it's you know, there's no doubt that the situation is dire, right? And we have some real challenges that we have to live up to. There's also a lot of promise. So what we're trying to do at the Sustainability Institute is say, look, there's if we behave more sustainably and really work on this idea of thriving, the future is really bright. And there are some exciting things that this future might look like. And so, you know, we sort of think of it this way, like there's the doom and gloom mentality that's out there. But if we really want to have a brighter future, one that's more vibrant and people are excited about, we have to help people write that story. And we do that by offering a more positive vision about what the future might look like. Because otherwise we're hearing this doom and gloom, and it's really tough to write a positive story if you never hear anything positive about the future.
Carrie, what's your perspective on the role of the Sustainability Institute in our community?
Yeah, I really would just want to double down and echo what Casey said. A big part of our mission is celebrating sustainability. So our focus is really sharing those stories, celebrating the sustainability leaders and actions that are happening now. A lot of people often get antsy or nervous when it comes to sustainability. Like Casey said, this idea of doom and gloom, you know, what can I do? And instead of kind of being stuck in that place of fear and worry, we want to say, hey, let's celebrate what's happening around us that's successful and share those stories to hopefully inspire others to take action or find connections and ways to take action so they feel like they are a part of our community and, you know, doing those things together.
And speaking of taking that action and celebrating what's going on right now, we are talking about the drawdown challenge, which has some really interesting ways for individual people to get involved on these issues of climate change and sustainability. Casey, you want to talk about the drawdown challenge and a little bit about just sort of the big picture about what it is?
First of all, Carrie and I really thought about this idea of engaging the community and how do we do that in a way that's positive and helps people sort of move forward. And last spring, we, in conjunction with the La Crosse Earth Fair, we did something called the Green Goose Chase. And that was a community-wide scavenger hunt that was done online and people could, you know, people could go out and work in teams to find different sustainability features within the area or do certain sustainable behaviors within the area. And what we found from that is that we had really good community engagement. It blew our minds. It was way better than what we anticipated. We had pretty high expectations. And so there was a large number of teams that joined the Green Goose Chase, you know, hundreds and hundreds of social media posts about it on the Goose Chase platform. It was just this great vibe that happened. And so Carrie and I really wanted to carry that forward. So we didn't have to wait for another year to do a Green Goose Chase. And so this opportunity, we started talking about, well, what could we do possibly in the fall? And we came up with the Drawdown Challenge. So this is an online challenge. It's actually, we didn't create this or anything like that. It comes from an organization called ecochallenge.org. And so they run this, have this platform that an online platform that allows people to take some actions towards climate change. And at any rate, we started what's called this drawdown challenge here in the area. And drawdown refers to that future point in time when levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is causing climate change, when those levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, when they stop climbing and start to steadily decline, that's called drawdown. And this is really the point that we can begin the process of stopping further climate change and averting potentially catastrophic warming. So that point is called drawdown. And there's all sorts of things that we can do to get to drawdown. So the drawdown challenge, what happens is participants select actions to do over a 3-week period. From October 4th through the 25th, I believe, is our challenge. And so they use the online platform to register their actions, to first of all, find some actions that they might want to take. And then they check in daily on this platform and check off their actions when they're complete. And then they get points for doing that. And the cool thing is during those 3 weeks, participants are accumulating points. But then we can also see the real-time collective impact of all of our actions and how much that's actually drawing down from the greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So, you know, another really cool thing about this challenge is that people, just like the Green Goose Chase, are going to be able to engage with each other on the platform. So it's got a little element of social media in there for people to, you know, cheer each other on and maybe even have a little bit of friendly competition about, you know, how much people can do. And the actions themselves, it's a fairly wide range of actions. So we tend to think that, you know, to draw down carbon out of the atmosphere, it's got to be things like saving energy, right? Turning off your lights, turning off your computer at the end of the day. Well, that's true, but there's also a lot of other actions that we can do that from Project Drawdown are sort of scientifically vetted to be solutions that exist now.
I was really surprised at some of the things that are listed. I mean, I obviously, like, drive less, don't put so much gas in your car, sure, whatever. That's obvious. But a lot of these things, you look at them and go, tell me how this connects to climate change. What are some of these activities that people can be involved in that they might be more surprised by?
The one that probably surprises most people is education. We can kind of think of three big buckets of what helps with climate change and what we need to do. One of those buckets is mitigation. So keeping the carbon out of the atmosphere in the first place. And those are the ones that are like sort of least surprising, right? Driving less and saving energy and going solar and stuff like that. Then there's another bucket of solutions that involves helping the Earth take in carbon, because that's another solution with climate change, right? And so it's stewarding the land, it's planting trees, it's making sure that we've got healthy soil, right? Because that sequesters carbon. And then there's this third group that really sort of blows people's minds, and that's just sort of improving society. One of them is making sure that girls and women have access around the world have access to education and access to healthcare and family planning should they want it. So that's a really big climate solution that we don't often think of. So by supporting those types of causes, you're also helping climate change. And you know, another big one that people don't always think of is the waste that we produce, in particular food waste. So throwing out a bunch of food, typically what happens is that food goes to the landfill. And when food goes to the landfill, it releases methane as it breaks down. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So in America, we typically, about 40% of our food doesn't actually make it to the plate or ends up in the landfill, I should say. And so that represents a really large amount of greenhouse gases going up in the atmosphere. So if we can do something about our food waste, that again is a great climate solution. And if we compost it, we're also creating soil, right? Which is healthy for the environment.
It's interesting to think about how much food, and you started by saying food that doesn't make it to our plate, but in a lot of cases, it absolutely makes it to our plate, and then we don't eat it and we throw it out. So maybe get a smaller plate, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's some really simple solutions that we can do. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Get a smaller plate, which automatically makes you take smaller portion sizes, right? That type of thing can happen in restaurants as well. Restaurants can decide to switch to smaller plates or give smaller portions. You know, we can really be mindful about the expiration dates on foods, because those expiration dates typically aren't really scientifically sound at all. So even though the expiration date might have, you know, a particular date on it, that doesn't always mean that the food is bad at that point. In fact, oftentimes that expiration date says best if used by. It doesn't mean that the food's gone bad at that point.
Carrie, I'm interested in some of these details. If people are wanting to participate or wanting to learn how they can get a team together, where can people find out about the Drawdown Challenge?
Sure. So we are encouraging everyone to join our team, the Sustainability Institute Drawdown Challenge team. So we'll be all competing on one team together. And internally within that team, we'll have a leaderboard for that little bit of competitiveness. But if people want to find more information or join our team, the best thing to do is to head to our website, which is sustaininstitute.com. And right on our homepage, we have a button that takes you to the drawdown challenge page. And from there, you're going to find all kinds of information about the challenge, how to join our team, what that collective impact is going to look like as we complete our actions, and more information as well. We also have some great videos that you can watch that take you step by step through that process in case you need more information.
So there's one team and the individual statistics, if you will be available there as well. But there's one team. Are we as a locality competing against other teams around the country?
So there are teams all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Which is amazing to see. Yeah. So what's great about this platform is it's going to do all of that formulation for us. So as soon as you complete your action, you're going to be able and filter to see your individual impacts or the impact of our Sustainability Institute team or everyone participating in the challenge across the world, which is really amazing to see how all of those actions combined together can really create a large impact.
And so the website where that information is again is what?
So to get more information about joining our team is sustaininstitute.com. And then that will take you, once you head there and head to our page, which is the drawdown challenge, that's going to take you to ecochallenge.org to go ahead and get signed up.
Now, this in and of itself has been an interesting conversation, but this isn't the only effort that you're involved in. Coming up later in October are the Sustainability Awards, and I know we likely won't have another opportunity to talk to you before then, so can you give us a bit of a preview?
Of course. So the great thing about the Drawdown Challenge and the Sustainability Institute, like we said, is we like to celebrate. So in addition to the Inspiring Sustainability Awards happening on October 28th at 6:30, it's a virtual ceremony event, so make sure to register for that. Part of that, we will be having the Drawdown Challenge impact presented. So we, during that presentation, will talk more about our team impacts. But during the awards, we're going to be announcing live our two winners for 2021. We had 9 amazing nominees this year, and we're excited to see who our winners will be. In addition to announcing our winners and recapping the results of the Drawdown Challenge, we're also going to have a guest speaker, which is Erin Sikorsky, who is the director for climate and security. She's also a local Holman grad, so she'll be speaking a little bit as well at that event. So we hope all of you join us, because the more the merrier when it comes to celebration.
And same website for information on that?
Correct. Head to sustaininstitute.com, and right on the top there, you're going to see upcoming events, and you'll be able to register for free. And again, it's a virtual ceremony event at 6:30 on October 28th.
Casey, you've mentioned several times about the sort of changing the paradigm about how we look at sustainability into one that's positive and forward-looking. And so as we wrap up our conversation, I want to give you an opportunity to do just that. A lot of people think about sustainability in terms of, I got to put solar panels on my house, I got to drive an electric car, I got to become a vegan, I got to, you know, what fill in the blank thing that's hard to do and that is cost prohibitive or discipline prohibitive for a lot of people. But a lot of your message is that there's something that everybody can do towards sustainability. So what are some of these small steps? Maybe a couple of things that you think pretty much everybody could do if they just decide to do it.
I think it is Americans. There are, you know, really there's 2 or 3 things that we can all do that probably have the biggest bang for the buck, just given our sort of position in the world. The first one would be think about your diet and reducing the amount of red meat in it. Now, listen, I'm a born and raised Wisconsin guy. I know that, you know, telling people to go vegetarian is not going to happen. But even just reducing your meat consumption, you know, taking one day a week and not eating meat, that's got a big climate impact. As we talked about earlier, the food waste is another big issue. So just being much more mindful about what's happening to our food that is on our plate that we don't eat and what we can do about that. So even starting a little compost pile or, you know, in Isle La Plume here in La Crosse, you can bring your food scraps and they turn it into compost and it's all free. So considering that, and then also consider how you might be able to, how to move yourself around without using a car. Doesn't mean giving up your car. It just means, you know, if you have multiple trips to make, multiple errands to run, try chaining them together. Or maybe there's an errand that you can run by using your bike because it's, you know, less than a mile or two away, or even walking. There's lots of things that we can do. Again, these sort of small things, not saying that that's going to solve the world, right? But these little things matter, because when we do these little things, what we found is you're much more likely to do bigger things later on. So these small steps you can take now actually sort of feed your soul and get you more interested and willing to do these bigger actions later on.
Casey Meehan is Director of Programming for the Sustainability Institute of La Crosse. Casey, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time.
And Carrie Thompson is the Operations and Programming Coordinator for the Sustainability Institute. Carrie, thanks for being on Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me, and we hope all of you will join us in the Drawdown Challenge.
Indeed so. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can catch our show every Friday morning at 10 o'clock on the Ideas Network 90.3, and on Friday evenings at 7 o'clock on NPR News and Music 88.9. And of course, we're always online at wpr.org/newsmakers. For Dawn Jewell, my producer, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next week for another Newsmakers, only right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.